Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, welcome to the HR Happy Hour Show. Oh, so great to be back. I'm excited for the show tonight. My name's Steve Bowes. Welcome. Thanks for coming back. Thanks for joining us. Perhaps if this is your first time listening to the show, we're really excited for tonight's show. We have a super show, a super guest on the line that we'll welcome in just a minute. Great topic tonight, and I'm really, really excited for the show. So, again, many, many thanks for joining us tonight, whether you're listening live or catching this later on the podcast or out on iTunes. Later on, this is the HR Happy Hour Show, episode 144. It's titled The American Way of Eating, the same title as the book. And our guest will be the author, Tracy McMillan, who will join us in a minute to talk all about The American Way of Eating, which is a remarkably fascinating, interesting book that I highly recommend checking out if you haven't already. We're recording this show live Thursday, May 3rd, 2012. Our call-in number for folks listening live is 646-378-1086. Press 1 if you want to get on board into the conversation tonight to ask a question or make a comment. As well, folks listening on the back channel, hang out on Twitter, as always, our hashtag HRHappyHour, HRHappyHour. We'll keep an eye on that as well for any comments, questions, concerns, or complaints, although I probably will ignore most of the complaints. A couple of quick announcements, of course. Our show is sponsored by our friends at Acquire. This episode of HR Happy Hour is brought to you by Acquire, the leader in workforce planning and analytics solutions. You can try Org Publisher Premier, the subscription-based software that's the holy grail of automatic org charts. And it really is. It's pretty cool software. Free as a 30-day no-hassle trial. If you like it and keep it, spin it to finance that you paid nothing for a month for your first month. So to get started on your Org Publisher Premier trial, you can visit Acquire.com, A-Q-U-I-R-E.com. And many thanks to the gang at Acquire. A couple other quick announcements. I was on the road all week, and I just wanted to say thanks and a shout-out to the folks at the IRIM event in Chicago, as well as the HCI Talent Acquisition event in New York City I was just at yesterday. Just fantastic events, both of them. Super time, super people. Was really happy to be a small part of those events, and many thanks to the folks at IRM and HCI, as well as thanks to all the folks who came out to listen to me ramble on and a couple of different presentations this week. Home next week, which is fantastic. The week after, I'll be out at the Recruiting Innovation Summit, May 17th and 18th. That's an ERE event. Lance Hahn, my good buddy, is putting that together, and it's going to be a tremendously exciting event, Recruiting Innovation Summit. Really looking forward to that out in Mountain View, May 17th and 18th. And finally, tonight, of course, my Knicks playing Miami, and there may be the occasional Knicks-Miami Heat score update. It looks like the Knicks are up by 2 points in the second quarter, so I'm very excited about that as well. So, all right, that's out of the way. That's the announcements. Let's get right to it. Our guest tonight, as I mentioned, is Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating. I'll read Tracy's short bio, and then we'll welcome her to the show, and we can talk some more. Tracy is the author of the recently published book, The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Tracy has written about food and class for a variety of publications, including The New York Times, O, The Oprah Magazine, Harper's Magazine, Savour, which I can tell I don't even read that magazine. Like I don't think I can pronounce the name of that magazine. That's like out of my league. And Slate. From 2001 to 2005, she was the managing editor of the award-winning magazine City Limits, where she won recognition from organizations ranging from the James Beard Foundation to World Hunger Year. She's based in Brooklyn. Tracy can also be found on the web at AmericanWayOfEating.wordpress.com, and she's also on Twitter, which is really cool. I love when the guests are on Twitter as well. And Tracy's Twitter handle is TM McMillan, TMMCMILAN. And enough of that nonsense. Tracy, welcome to the HR Happy Hour Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tracy, thanks so much for doing the show. It's been, well, first of all, congratulations on The American Way of Eating and all the success you've had. It's just fantastic. It has to have been just a whirlwind few months for you and since the book's come out.
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy. You know, it came out in late February, and you know, it's my first book, so you know, there's a lot of talk with your publisher and your publicist at that point about, you know, managing your expectations, and you know, you might not get a review everywhere, and you know, don't get too excited. And I've just been really, really blessed that it's gotten a fair amount of attention from all the major outlets. And certainly has been a part of discussion in ways that, you know, you always hope will happen, but there's never any guarantee. And so that's just been really gratifying and great to see.
Yeah, and perhaps even some discussion and attention in ways you never would have expected, which we might talk about later in the show as well.
Definitely.
A couple of months ago. So I read the book, Tracy, right after it came out. I had read some excerpts of the book that ran, I believe, in Slate.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought the book and read it. And so we had been working on this appearance for a while with your publishers and publisher trying to work it into your schedule. And soon after we had sort of settled on, yeah, you could do the show and you'd come on, then boom, you're on MSNBC and CNN, you're everywhere, and I'm thinking, oh, there's no way I'll get the appearance now, right? So I'm really glad you stuck it out and made it to the show tonight, so we're really excited about that. So
no worries.
Thank you so much, Tracy. So folks for folks who are listening tonight or may not be familiar with the book, just tell us a little bit about the book, maybe in general, and a little bit about the backstory about what led you down the path to take on the topic of food in America, which led to what's now become the book, The American Way of Eating. How did it all start?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start out with sort of how I got started on this. I come into food writing from a sort of strange perspective, which is that I'm trained as a welfare and poverty reporter. So if, you know, 6 years ago, if you'd asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, even though, you know, I was already, you know, fairly grown up at that point, I would have said, oh, I want to write about welfare and poverty and low-wage work. And, you know, there's just not a really good freelance market for that, and I really wasn't on track to get a job at the New York Times or any place like that. I've mostly worked in independent media. So I said, well, okay, I've got to figure out something. And I had done a little bit of work around food access, which is sort of this idea that some neighborhoods don't really have sufficient grocery stores for the population there. And I thought that was really interesting, and I really like to cook. I'm from a working-class white background outside of Flint, Michigan. And I had always sort of had this persnickety sort of stance around discussions of food, which is that, you know, where I grew up and the families I grew up with, you know, we all cared about what we ate and we all, you know, appreciate good food. It's just that doing it took so much time and so much energy and so much money that we often didn't. And then, you know, I'd move to New York and work for all these wealthy families, and they would sort of, in a very nice way, be a little condescending, right, about the sort of food that I must have grown up with and things like that.
And I feel, Tracy, I'm probably similar to you as well. I think I know I ate a lot of, you know, hamburger helper, you know, growing
right.
up. I think I know I was there. I remember it well.
Yeah, well, and you know, I think I probably went through a period in college of being like, oh, gosh, I can't believe, you know, I was eating stuff like that. I mean, mostly the way anybody from a rural background that goes to college in New York City probably feels, right? Like you
right.
go through this period of sort of wanting to distance yourself from where you grew up. And then, you know, I got into being in New York for a few years, and I was like, well, actually, I don't see what's really wrong with eating that way. I mean, that's what was available. It's what was affordable. And, you know, my dad was raising us pretty much by himself because my mom was sick. Like, why would you sneer down at people for eating like that? Like, that sort of seemed silly. So I always had this sort of, you know, idea in my head that somebody needed to have a conversation about how food really worked in the families that I had grown up with and the families that I reported on as a poverty reporter. And, you know, about, you know, your listeners probably know, you know, around 2006, 2007, there started to be this really big discussion around eating locally and seasonally and organically and sustainably and figuring all that stuff out. And particularly because diet-related health problems are such a big issue.
Sure.
In lower-income communities, it just seemed kind of ridiculous to me, right, that the whole discussion around eating well was being shaped as if everybody had infinite time and money, right,
yeah.
to make those decisions. So part of it, you know, I tell this joke a lot. I say, you know, I sat down with an agent, and she said, you know, well, what do you really want to write about? And, you know, some version of foodies are really irritating, and I want them to shut up and be realistic, right?
Right.
Probably
right.
is what came out of my mouth. I'd like to think I was more articulate than that. And so that really is what led me into doing The American Way of Eating. And, you know, so for folks that haven't, you know, spent time paying close attention to everything I've ever done.
What? How dare they? I know. I feel the same way when people do that to me,
too. I can explain the book, which was...
selfish, yeah.
Right. So I decided, I'm trained as an investigative reporter. I decided what I wanted to do is I wanted to go and work in three different parts of the food system. And here I was definitely borrowing from Barbara Ehrenreich and her book Nickel and Dimed, which came out in, I think it was 1999 or 2000,
okay.
Where she went and she worked in three low-wage jobs. One was at Walmart, one was as a housekeeper, I think one was, waitressing. So she had gone and done these low-wage jobs as a way to look at what happened after welfare reform. And I said, well, you know, we keep talking about eating well being really easy, but we're not talking to anybody that actually, anybody of the sort of social class where that's actually really important.
Right, where it's so, really true, exactly, right. And
so
you make a really good point there that a lot of people who talk about this, it's easy because we have lots of options, we have lots of time, and we'll get into some of this in the book. When you talked about Walmart, for example, and how much of the food supply that they control, when I read that, I thought, well, I never would have guessed that because, now at this point in my life, I'm not probably shopping for my food at Walmart, so it just never occurred to me that was the case, you know, and I think that's an important point you make.
Yeah, well, and in the really big coastal cities, Walmart just doesn't have that strong of a presence, but pretty much everywhere else in the country they do. So actually, for about 4 months, I was living with friends of friends in this little town in New Mexico to write my book, you know, because I just didn't have the wherewithal or the resources to apply for, you know, these fancy writing fellowships, and you have to get accepted, and you know, that's not a definite, and then what do you do if you don't
right.
get in? Right. So I was like, well, I know some people with a trailer in the mountains in New Mexico, so I'll just go live
right.
there, right? But in that town, you know, there was a Walmart, and then there was, one really small local grocery store, and there was a small food cooperative. But primarily, you know, Walmart was the main food supply there, and that's the case actually in a lot of places around the country. So, you know, in the book I write about how Walmart's 25% roughly of America's food supply right now, but nobody's shopping sort of as a national average, right? Like I live in Brooklyn. I'm not comparing
sure.
prices with, you know, something in Seattle.
Right.
And with places like Walmart, Walmart tends to be more like 50, 60, 70% of market share in a lot of places where it's operating, which means it's de facto, you know, the food supply for an entire town. And I've just found
yeah.
that to be really, actually a little scary, right? Like,
I know. I want to come back to that part of the, that part of the book certainly in a few minutes, because there's some interesting observations you make about the relative control over a local population's supply of fresh produce and the decision-making, right, power that's put in the hands of some folks who may or may not really know all that well what they're doing in this sort of weird kind of amount of power that they have. But, Chase, let me do a quick pause and reset and just reset the audience. This is the HR Happy Hour Show. My name's Steve Bowes. Our guest tonight is Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Fantastic book. Totally recommend you check it out. You know, Amazon, everywhere you get books, you'll find it. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of the work experiences Tracy had in doing her sort of research and field work for the book, and which are fascinating as well. Because this show, Tracy, is really, you know, typically a human resources focused show, workplace focused show. So I think the parts of your experience. When I read the book too, I'm thinking about it through that lens a little bit as well. The book's about food, right, and how it gets grown, how it gets processed, how it gets shipped, how it gets sold, and then ultimately consumed, you know, in America. But it's also so much about work itself. And obviously you were doing all these jobs across the country and in different parts of the food, I guess the food chain, is that even the way to say it, but the food distribution chain. And I thought, too, it's like, so many people, though, even though we maybe forget about it as we get older, if we move on in our lives and do more, quote-unquote, you know, professional jobs for what it's worth, I mean, I bet there's a huge percentage of people who sometime in their life, you know, even if it was in their high school or college, were part of that chain as well. Either they worked in fast food or they worked at the local supermarket. I had a job for a couple of summers working in a refrigerated food distribution warehouse.
Oh, my gosh.
The whole place, it was a giant warehouse, but it was kept at, you know, 30, I guess about 36 degrees.
Right.
And so it was like eggs and milk and orange juice and packaged meats. And we would prepare the orders that went out to, you know, the grocery stores as well as the convenience stores. And we did it all night long on these carts. So, but every, I mean, it seems like lots of people have been in this chain at some point in their lives as well.
Yeah, and I don't know the exact statistics, but the grocery industry, the National Restaurant Association, like all those trade groups that represent different food workers, and particularly there's a group called the Food Chain Workers Alliance, you know, they all make the point that a huge section of the American population is at some point involved in making the food system work. And that's really why I thought it would be very interesting to sort of go and work, you know, first as a farm worker in California, so out in the fields in the Central and Salinas Valleys.
Yeah, right. So, like, can we start there, Tracy, and just talk a little bit about that? Because that, I mean, that's the sort of the first part section of the book, really, when you say, I'm going to learn about how this is happening and how food makes it from the farm to the table. So you went to the farms, and a number of them. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about some of your, just a couple of your experiences working in the farms, and then maybe some of the things, one or two items maybe that you picked up from actually doing the work that really resonated with you, or perhaps that the, I don't know, people that you've talked to around the country as you've been talking about the book don't really understand or don't really realize about working, actually working in the farm fields as you did.
Yeah, sure. So in terms of doing the work out in California, you know, I don't think I had realized when I went out there that, you know, I am a profoundly Eastern person,
right, in terms
of the U.S., right? I'm from Michigan. I've lived in New York since 1994, and so if you, you know, I'm sort of like, okay, I'll go out and I'll work at these big fields in California, and I thought they would be green, right? I thought that it would look like farms out here,
like the
thicker.
Yeah, like the Hidden Valley Ranch you see on the commercials, and the family
like
picnicking,
like, oh,
in the grove.
Yeah, it'll be industrial.
It'll be like that, yeah.
It'll be bigger, but it'll still be, like, green. And sort of the shocker to me, even though intellectually I knew this, is that California is an incredibly arid and dry place. Like, all that agriculture is irrigated. So all the fruits and vegetables that come out of the Central and Salinas Valleys, and the Central Valley itself is responsible for, I mean, over a third of the food that's produced in the U.S. The Salinas Valley is responsible for a very large proportion of vegetables, fruits, nuts, all that stuff that's all often coming out of California. That's all done through an irrigated system and under temperatures that are incredibly difficult. So, you know, when I was sorting peaches in California, you know, we reached a heat wave. This is, you know, this felt like a heat wave to me being from out east, but it's not actually that unusual in the Central Valley, where it was 105, 107 degrees every day. And so I actually got heat sick. And so there's actually a statistic, I think it's within the last 15 or 20 years, something like 70 farm workers have died from heat in that part of the country. And these are deaths that are entirely preventable, right? It just means that you need shade and water. And so something that really, really shocked me was I was doing a little bit of just sort of finishing up some reporting around mechanizing. So I wasn't even trying to get any interesting quotes around farm work. I just was calling someone who had created a machine to harvest lettuce. And I was sort of asking, why is that important? You know, who's buying these things? And this guy who's actually on the board of the Western Growers Association said, well, you know, it's just so difficult with labor these days. You have to do, we're completely overregulated. You have to do all of these things, like you have to give them water. And you have to give
right.
them
shade. How dare they? Yeah, those pesky workers.
And this I was like, you know, I could see you feeling like, you know, there's a lot of paperwork involved with immigration, for instance, that does seem like that would take up a lot of energy if you were a small farmer without a huge staff. But I'm like, shade and water, like, you would give that to horses working, I would imagine, like, you can do it for the farm workers.
Yeah, in the book, Tracy, I don't have the page number, so forgive me on that, but I have this in my notes as a quote I pulled from the book, and talking about just the condition for the workers at the farms. And here's the quote, and I highlighted it because I thought it was really interesting. That in here, it's under federal labor laws, as a farm worker, I have no rights to days off, I have no right to overtime pay, and I have no right to collective bargaining, right? And so, and it's just like striking, right, when you see that, just boom, you know, you've got these really tough, and the reasons why, right, why don't they have those kinds of rights? And you talk also in the book, interestingly enough, like similar to the Apple situation with the Foxconn factory workers that we've seen a lot about in the last few months, right? It's been all over the New York Times and other places, right? This Apple's churning out these billions of dollars of profits, and the Foxconn workers, right, are making no money, and they're jumping off the roof, and all these terrible things that are happening out there. That gets lots of attention, maybe because it's Apple, and we can all really relate to that because, you know, just about all of us are walking around with an iPhone or an iPad or something. But similarly to how in those stories, it seems like the actual wages of those factory workers don't really contribute all that much to the price of the gadgets in the long run. I think you made the same point about the farm workers' wages as well, right? That, you know, the what they're getting paid, which isn't much, doesn't really affect the end price of the product in the stores all that much.
Yeah, well, this actually really surprised me, you know, because I had obviously done the advance reporting before I went out there, and I talked to a bunch of growers, and everyone would say, well, you know, we pay our workers more than minimum wage. I mean, I can get into why they say that in a second. And besides, you know, if you were going to make wages any higher, then food would be unaffordable, which is really interesting because it's not actually true, right? The average dollar we spend on food at the store, about 85% of that goes to all the marketing and distribution and transportation and logistics that comes after the farm. Only about 16% goes to the farm, and labor is a subset of that. And you know, often farm labor can be, you know, a third of what the farmer is paying, but that brings us down to like 5% of the purchase price. Right.
Yeah.
So in terms of farm labor, you can certainly pay more. And something that has really come to light to me, both from that reporting, from additional reporting I've been doing since then on farm labor, is that because farm labor right now is very frequently done through farm labor contractors, right, which sort of operate the same way Foxconn did for Apple, right? So this is a separate entity that handles all of the labor. They falsify the documentation that they give to the company. So, you know, I was working for El Bajio contractor, and so the El Bajio would provide paperwork to the garlic company and to Christopher Ranch, and what they would do is they would doctor the paperwork, making it look as though everyone was being paid minimum wage or higher. And so when you talk to growers, they have all this paperwork coming to them from the contractors that says, oh, everybody made minimum wage or they made more. So I've actually seen piece stubs for onion workers where if you just go by what's on the sort of piece of paper they got from the foreman in the field, they're making $17 to $20 an hour picking onions, which is not the case at all. What happens is the mayordomos change the number of hours on the card. That, you know, they falsify little things so that the actual paperwork makes it look like people are raking in money working in the fields, and in actuality, you know, they're often earning less than minimum wage.
Right, and the gist of it to me, or maybe one of the points anyway, was that, like, I don't think anybody who's not familiar with that kind of work has the expectation or the belief that it's, oh, it's not that bad. I mean, I think everybody thinks it's very tough, very difficult, but I think the truth of it is it's probably even more tough, more difficult, and really hard on the people who do it, even beyond what we even think, right? Until you experience it, you might not – You couldn't know, I suppose.
Right. Well, that was certainly my experience. Because if you had asked me, you know, what is it going to be like before I went out there, I said, oh, it's going to be very hard, it'll be very dirty, and I'm not going to make very much money at all. But in the back of my head, not much money at all would have still been minimum wage. And I was earning $2 to $4 an hour.
Yeah, and I mean, we probably won't have time to get into all those details, but in the book, you break down as you move around to these different jobs, right, how much you're earning, how much you're spending on, you know, lodging and you know, basic resources and your food, your own food consumption bills as well, because you're trying to, you know, underscoring the larger point that it's sort of how work ties into how we eat and live, right? That it's not easy to eat well, right, when you're struggling to get by, to keep a roof over your head, to get to where your job is, to keep your car on the road, and all the things that you struggled with in the book and you talk about quite eloquently.
Right.
Yeah, so let me do a quick reset, Tracy. This is Steve Bowes, HR Happy Hour Show. I'm joined by Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating. Our call-in number tonight, 646-378-1086. There's a lot of folks on the line on hold. If anybody who's online actually wants to come on and ask a question or make a comment and talk to Tracy, please do press 1 on your phone, and we'll definitely open up your line straight away. For folks who are listening and hanging out on the back channel as well, hello, HR Happy Hour on Twitter is our hashtag. Of course, Tracy's on Twitter as well, TM McMillan. You can find her there, as well as her website, theamericanwayofeating.wordpress.com as well. So, Tracy, so you spent a lot of time working in a few different farms, peaches, grapes, a grape vineyard, garlic field, which I think for some reason that one resonated with me the most. But from there, from that experience, you move to sort of the next step in the book, which is talking about, well, how does the food go from these fields where, you know, it's grown and harvested and picked and whatnot and sorted? How does it sort of get out to where people can buy it, which is sort of the supermarket? But as you talked about the supermarket, it's really not just the actual store, right? It's this whole ecosystem, this whole distribution chain that is really fascinating. And specifically around, you worked at a couple of Walmarts, and I mentioned earlier that the influence Walmart has on the food supply, it just was surprising to me how dominant it is. Another quote from the book about Walmart I'll mention here is, you write, "Walmart's share of our food supply has grown at an unparalleled pace. At 22%, it now sells more than twice as much as the next three largest stores combined." I'd love for you to comment a little bit about, is that bad, or should we really be worried about that? And how, and then maybe talk a little bit about your experience working in the Walmart and how sort of food gets to where people can buy it in those settings.
Sure. So, you know, as we mentioned before, that 22% number is a national average. So most communities where Walmart's operating, it's a much bigger share than that.
Sure.
And what happens is as you get up into 30%, 35% of market share, you really start to see a lack of competition emerge, just because there's such a dominant market share from one company, and they start to be able to set prices and they don't have to compete. You know, we're such a market-based economy, but there's this idea in our heads, I think, that, you know, all these different companies just compete on who can do the lower price.
Right.
And what started to happen is that because Walmart has so much power, doesn't have to compete on price, so there's actually a number of studies showing that it's not always lower on price, and even a spot check that I did between Walmart and my local grocery store in Detroit showed that, you know, Walmart almost always wins on price on processed food, but if you're looking at fruits and vegetables and fresh meat, it loses. It was, in fact, 7% cheaper for me to buy fruits and vegetables at the local Detroit grocery and about 15% cheaper to buy my meat locally than driving out to a Walmart. And so, you know, when we say is it good or is it bad, you know, the laws and economics are that as market concentration increases, right, which is to say the fewer competitors that there are in a marketplace, the higher prices will get. And so there's no, you know, Walmart's a privately traded it's a private company that is publicly traded. Its job is to make a profit. I just personally have no reason to think that they would keep charging us lower prices if they could get away with charging us more.
Right, sure.
And right now, the way that supermarkets actually compete isn't actually so much by lowering prices more and more on food, but by cutting their costs internally. And so that's been this whole revolution in distribution and transportation and logistics, which is really interesting because what that does is in order to have a distribution logistics empire, you have to be a really big player.
Right. And so, scale is really important in this, right, which is something you talk about a good bit in the book, just the sheer size of this distribution engine, I guess, that they've developed over the years.
Yeah, so it really now almost all of our distribution of food is controlled by the private sector. And there's pretty much no government oversight of where food goes or who gets it or what quality of food or anything like that, which is why you end up with problems like food deserts, right? Because the market decides that there's not money to be made by selling often, but not always, in lower-income communities. And so they don't put stores there. Often, and I write about this in the book, that's because supermarket sort of business practices were developed with the suburbs in mind. And so as the population has urbanized and you've developed sort of low-income neighborhoods in urban areas, like the models for would a store work here absolutely don't transpose into an urban area because they're designed for the suburbs, which means, you know, size of your store and whether or not there's a place to put a parking lot and what the median income is versus population density. There's all these things, right, that work fine in the suburbs and don't work in an urban environment.
Right, I thought about that. Yeah, Tracy, I think that's a great point. I want to sort of touch on the food desert idea a little bit as well. But I thought about it more since reading the book, right, which is, I guess, a sign of a good book, right? It makes you think beyond, not just about when you've read it, but afterwards. So I live in upstate New York, and I live a couple of miles away from a grocery store called Wegmans, which is a big chain up here in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
And I live the store I live closest to is their flagship store, like this.
Right,
and it's this massive. It's a great place. I'm not knocking Wegmans. It's a great company. It makes America's most admired companies or best places to work list. It's always in the top. It's a fantastic store. I love it. But you're right. That model, and they've been under some pressure here in the city. I live just outside of Rochester, New York, for closing a couple of their stores much closer to the inner part, the core of the city, the central city, right, where the footprints were much smaller. Their dollar volumes weren't going to be sufficient to match, right, their business model. And they've pulled out to create more of these giant megalopolis kind of stores out where there's, an acre of parking and, lots of people can drive to those stores. And it just does. I thought about it a lot. So, Tracy, it's in Detroit, you spend a lot of time working at these Walmarts, and we could talk a little bit about that, but also just living in the Detroit area, as you were, and talking about your options for food and the people's options for purchasing fresh and healthy and good food in places like Detroit or other cities. I wonder if you could comment a little bit about that and maybe what some of the things that maybe you've seen or you know about that are changing in these places for the better, right, to try to, help with this problem of food deserts and such.
Sure. Well, Detroit is just such a fascinating place. Obviously, it's got, this very difficult economic history right now, as well as a lot of really interesting work being done to sort of rebirth the city and a lot of interesting energy around it. It's been known for quite a while now as one of the worst food deserts in the country, mostly because of the absence of any national grocery stores.
Right.
And it's important to use that word national because it does still have around 80 to 90 independently owned grocery stores, some of which
okay.
are excellent quality and some of which are not. But what I found in Detroit is that what is ubiquitous is what in local parlance is called party stores. And so those are basically liquor store, corner stores. They'll have a little bit of food, just enough food to qualify for the food stamp and WIC programs.
Okay.
Usually they don't stock fruits and vegetables. That's changed a little bit with the introduction of WIC fruit and vegetable vouchers. So these are new vouchers added onto the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program that are specifically for fruits and vegetables. And so that's helping to spur the development of small-scale produce distribution networks. And that's really important because one thing that has happened as our grocery distribution has gotten centralized in big companies like Walmart or Kroger or Meijer is that any small-scale distribution sort of disappeared because if
okay.
you couldn't order an entire semi-truck worth of peppers, there was nobody
right.
to deliver it. Because, a little corner
yeah.
store, right, they need like a half a bushel.
Right.
So
right,
who could
right.
like make that
right.
delivery every few days, right? So those WIC vouchers have really helped to spur some experiments in getting small-scale distribution in place to bring that into neighborhoods. And I think stuff like that's really promising, right? Like, I don't think you have to have supermarkets to fix food access problems necessarily, but you do need some kind of an infrastructure. And for me, that's what's been interesting about supermarkets. It's not so much I love supermarkets, but because they're shorthand for the idea of food distribution and food infrastructure. And
yeah.
Detroit is particularly interesting because they've had a lot of interest in urban agriculture projects. And so this is folks growing their own fruits and vegetables, not just in backyard garden for their own consumption, but to sell outside of their own home. And there's actually a network there called the Gardening Resource Program, which functions under the Detroit Agriculture Network. And they've been so successful that they formed a cooperative called Grown in Detroit, where they sell every week at the farmers market in Detroit. So there's this wonderful, wonderful wholesale and retail farmers market called Eastern Market in Detroit. It's one of the few public markets still operating in the country. And so every Saturday, that's a bustling place, and they sell off there. And actually this year, I believe, Grown in Detroit will be opening and operating I believe they're calling it a market and education garden. So what it will be is
okay.
essentially a do-it-yourself extension service to really deal with experimenting with different ways to do urban food production and cultivation and figuring that stuff out. There are currently, I've met two or three urban farmers who started out, sort of selling their overstock at the market have since branched out and now grow for market on their own plots and have their own stands at the market. So this is stuff that's actually fairly viable, and certainly I think contradicts the notion that you've seen from a lot of supermarkets that there's nobody in town that wants to buy the kind of food that they want to
sell.
Yeah,
right. That's kind of what I was thinking of, Tracy, as you were talking about that. There's a couple of things. One was in reaction to this problem of just not really having an adequate or accessible or high enough quality, whatever the case may be, supply of fresh and good food and produce and whatnot, that cities like Detroit and probably others as well have started to react and to take steps to grow more food locally and support groups to help people grow that and stuff. But it fights against that notion that nobody would want this, right? So the supermarkets, the big supermarkets all leave, and the perception is, well, they leave because there's no market there, or nobody wants this food. People would prefer, I guess, right? People would prefer to just buy processed stuff, packaged stuff, you know, convenience store stuff, and that's probably not the case, even though it can be sort of a misconception people might have.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I've reported on urban agriculture a lot. I've reported on it here in New York, actually. I've reported on it in Oakland and a little bit in Los Angeles. And what's been really interesting to me is that, like, here in New York, there can be a real tendency to say, oh, it's just a bunch of hipsters that are growing cute things on rooftops. It's
right.
A hipster thing.
Right.
And actually, urban agriculture has always been strongest in low-income communities where there wasn't that much available in terms of supermarkets, because people wanted and understood the need for fresh food.
Right.
And so that's been really interesting. And very tellingly, actually, Whole Foods announced last summer that they'll be opening a store in Detroit. And one of the reasons that they gave is because there is such an obvious interest in an appreciation of good food in that city despite the absence of these national grocers. So I believe they're slated to open their doors in 2013. And it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how that kind of a store functions in that community. That I believe they're also planning on having classes on how to shop cheaply at
right.
Whole Foods
okay.
for local residents.
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, I want to pivot just slightly, just because I know we're going to run out of time. But the one other thing I wanted to ask you about Walmart, which, you know, again, thinking about sort of work, you spent time working at two different Walmarts, and Walmart is the biggest private employer in the United States, I believe, still, and maybe even or one of the largest in the world, probably. Just a couple thoughts on what did you actually do working in the Walmart, and what was it like to work at the Walmart?
Yeah, so working at Walmart, I have to confess, it's sort of the first corporate job I've had as an adult.
right, right.
I realized after I was there for a little bit, I was like, oh, I've actually never worked somewhere with rules like this.
Yeah,
this
you really... had to wear a uniform or a tag, right?
Right, this is really interesting,
yeah.
But okay, that's cool, I can figure this out. You know, there just didn't seem to be a real appreciation and respect for at least my time and a lot of the other workers' time. When I worked I worked twice at a Walmart. On the night shift, I actually worked with a fair number of couples who made a choice to sort of stay at Walmart because the people they're scheduling would work with them to sort
okay.
of support their schedules and the things they were trying to do. But one thing that happened that I sort of found fairly offensive was that when I came close to hitting overtime hours, which were hours I had been scheduled for, you know, my boss came up to me and said, oh, Tracy, look, you're going to hit overtime. Can you just not come in tomorrow?
Right.
Right. So instead of letting me get 2 hours of overtime, they took away an 8-hour shift from me.
Right.
And what they would
okay.
do with other workers is sometimes they would say, oh, could you just take like a 3-hour lunch? Because
yeah,
you're gonna
I remember
overtime.
That in the book. Yeah, yeah.
Right, and
that's
I want to point
convenient.
Out, you know,
yeah.
lunch starts at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
So it's basically, why don't you just hang out unpaid at work for 3 hours in the middle
yeah.
of the night?
From 2 to 4 a.m. at the Walmart. That's
right.
exciting.
And I
yeah.
certainly saw at the Walmart where I worked in produce that there was not a commitment to providing quality produce. The manager for my department was 20 years old. He had just been transferred over from electronics, and he clearly had not been trained very well in how to deal with produce at all. So, you know, I write about this in the book. There was a day where I threw away 200 pounds of moldy asparagus that had been sitting in the walk-in cooler for over a month.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and things like this where I was like, there's no system, and things aren't getting thrown out, and there was, you know, this terrible leak in the cooler that was there for almost an entire month. So, you know, we had, like, buckets of water overflowing in the cooler at all times, which, you know, certainly isn't good for things to be, you know, kept fresh there. You know, and I learned a few tricks for keeping stuff fresher longer at home. So stuff like crisping, which is slicing the bottom off of, you know, a head of lettuce, you know, just a thin coin off the bottom of the stalk, or off of, you know, your parsley, your cilantro, whatever. Cut off the sort of dead, dry part. Soak it briefly in warm water, lukewarm, because it'll open up the cell walls, and then flash it in cold water and refrigerate it, and it'll perk it all right back up, which is a really good trick to know. But, you know, what I now know is that when I go into a grocery store, if the cilantro is really short and there's no roots and it's not a very tall bunch, it's been in there for a really long time.
Right, exactly. The smaller the head of lettuce is, the smaller the cilantro, that's your signal, right? Yeah,
right, or cabbages. You know, if cabbages are really small, but there are some other larger heads, chances are they've just peeled off a lot of the bad leaves.
Right. Yeah, again, reset real quick. This is the HR Happy Hour Show. My name's Steve Bowes. Our guest is Tracy McMillan. We're talking about her book, The American Way of Eating, just a fascinating book all about how food gets grown, how it gets shipped, how it gets retailed, marketed, sold, and how many of us actually eat in America. And it's a remarkably interesting book, and I definitely recommend you checking it out. We've got a few minutes left, Tracy. Again, folks on the line, again, want to jump into the conversation, please feel free, 646-378-1086. Press 1, and we'll open up the line straight away. And Twitter, HR Happy Hour, is our back channel. I haven't been looking at the tweets too much, but I'll just say hey to everybody out there on the back channel tonight, and thanks so much for joining us and hanging out with us tonight as we go a little bit outside of our normal sort of work, talent, recruiting kind of topics and talk about something I think slightly more interesting anyway. So, Tracy, here's the thing. We're just glossing over these experiences, believe me. I mean, the book's several hundred pages long, and we can't really do all these experiences justice in just a conversation. But the third sort of leg of your journey, right, along the journey of food, essentially, you decided to take a job, or you tried to and eventually got a job. It wasn't like you just decided, right? You didn't have all these jobs land. You had to go find them, right, which I found
interesting
as well.
Right, I had to go to a job hunt.
Yeah, exactly. This wasn't some pre-seeded thing. Okay, this wasn't like Undercover Boss where you just showed up at the store and had a job waiting for you. So you ended up working at an Applebee's in Brooklyn, New York. And the funny thing, when I got to that part of the book, or Applebee's, and I thought, oh, my God, I've eaten. So my dad has been sick off and on a lot in the last couple of years. And every time I go to see him and stay with my sister, right, who lives down near where he lives, the closest restaurant to where she lives is an Applebee's. And I've probably eaten in an Applebee's like 35 times in the last 2 years, the same one, right?
Right.
And I think to myself, I kind of like the Applebee's. I don't mind it, right? But I never really thought much about it, right, that I read the book. And I still like it, quite frankly. I still like eating
there. Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's anything all that wrong with eating at Applebee's. I just certainly have a much more specific idea about what I'm getting when I eat there.
Yeah.
And but sort of what the trade-offs I'm making are, so.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about, well, first of all, why did you decide to go work in sort of, instead of like, because I would think, well, maybe Tracy, would you look at a McDonald's or a Burger King? That might be sort of the what someone might expect you'd go investigate and research a little bit more. But why did you sort of go maybe up the casual chain slightly and end up in an Applebee's? What was
your
thinking?
Sure, yeah. Well, basically, I felt like Eric Schlosser had really covered the problems with fast food and Fast Food Nation, and I didn't know that I was going to be able to, expand on or bring a whole lot more to that. And also just narratively, a restaurant kitchen at an Applebee's just tends to be a lot more fast-paced and have more going on in it than you see at a McDonald's kitchen.
Right,
So I was really interested in that. And I also was really interested because I felt like, most people know that eating at McDonald's is not a healthy thing, right? Like that's
I think
something
so.
That
yeah,
we've
yeah.
all sort of grasped and we understand. But when you're going out to eat at a place like Applebee's, and the reason I picked Applebee's in specific is because it is the largest casual sit-down restaurant in the country.
Okay.
Applebee's is sort of a place you go where you're like, oh, I'm going to get a decent meal. It's not junk food. It's not fast food. Even if you're getting something, even if you're getting like the fried chicken whatever with French fries, I feel like the idea in your head is to like you're going out for a nice meal.
Right.
And so I
was
like, well, what are we actually getting when we go out for that nice meal? Because McDonald's, you can make the argument, you're like, it's $5 or $6 and I'm fed. So even if it's kind of crappy food for me, I did only pay $5 or $6. But Applebee's,
and I was in and out of there in 20
minutes.
Right.
At least in New York, they're that high. So, I sort of said, I think it'd be really interesting to go and do that. And so that was really, it's actually the job I enjoyed the most. out of the three that I took during the course of the book. You know, I like kitchen work. And as I write in the book, you know, I couldn't actually get myself hired into prep or on the line, right, which is doing the actual cooking. And so instead what I did is I took a job as an expediter. And so that's the person who's sort of trafficking all the food in between the line and the floor. And I did well enough at it that my managers, you know, were sort of really encouraging me to stay on, to consider management. And I did have one of them tell me, he said, you know, if I could clone you, I'd just put all of you on the line. I'd love to have you work on the line.
Right.
And, you know, part of me was thinking, well, geez, like that would totally pay better than writing.
Yeah, steady work, right?
work, nice enough people. You know, I could do worse.
Discount or free meals probably as well, right? You probably
right,
got
yeah,
the,
well, and that was one of the things that really saved me economically, you know. So
sure.
Restaurant work is sort of notorious for having a lot of really informal agreements. And when I was hired, I was told I'd be paid $8 an hour during training and $9 an hour once I was actually working full time. And what ended up happening is I got paid minimum wage at $7.45 during training and then $8 an hour once I was on full, you know, working full time, which is, you know, fairly significant over the course of a couple of months.
Well, on a percentage basis, that's incredibly significant, right? That's
right.
That's a huge increase or decrease, if you will, that you
didn't
get.
And so being able to say, well, every time I work, I'm going to get, you know, one big meal that's going to be, like, enough calories for my day.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, and I pretty quickly learned, like, once or twice, I said, oh, I'll be healthy and I'll get a salad. And you know, nothing comes fresh into the Applebee's kitchen in terms of produce other than lettuce, like heads of iceberg lettuce, tomatoes and onions, because those are all things that have to be put on the burgers in a fairly natural form. Everything else, all the lettuce in the salads, all of the broccoli, that stuff is all pre-cut somewhere else and comes in big bags and gets, you know, portioned out and then microwaved. And I write about this in the book. One of the things that happens when you microwave the sides, so you'd microwave the broccoli, you'd microwave mashed potatoes. Mashed potatoes actually were made from real potatoes that were then mixed with this white liquid that came in called garlic milk. So anyway, you portion it out into baggies, and then, you know, the folks would microwave it. But what happens is the plastic degrades in the microwave, and then when it's under the heat lamp, and when, as an expediter, when I'd have to empty those bags out onto the plate before they went out, plastic would flake out onto the food. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
Right, because you can't sit there and, like, pick it off
before
it melts. Yeah. So it just goes out into people's food.
Right, and there must be, and no one's dropping dead from this, so we must now be able to assume it's okay, but it still doesn't sound great, right?
Right, and
it's,
ostensibly, small, like, smidge of, you know, petrochemical isn't going to kill you. If there are people who eat at Applebee's, like, multiple times a day, like, maybe that's not the best thing for them on that level. But there are other problems with the food there, probably, if you're eating it daily as well.
Yeah, no, I'll bet. You know, one of the statistics you cite in the book is that, and this, again, is probably, I believe, Tracy, I don't have that part noted, but it probably is just an overall average, is that by 2010, Americans were spending 42% of our food budgets in restaurants. And that really surprised me. That seemed really high to me. Like I wouldn't have guessed it to be that high.
Yeah, well, and actually it was much higher in 2008, I think, when I was starting to report the proposal for the book. Before the recession hit in 2008, it was more like a 48-52 split, with 48% going to restaurants. So it's almost half of our incomes were being spent on food outside of the home, which represents just like a really big shift and trend that's been happening over time. And so, you know, that's another reason that I felt like I really needed to go to a restaurant, because I said, well, I can report on what I'm doing at home cooking during all of this, but that's only half of what most people are doing
when
it comes to eating out. And something more interesting, which came out sometime in January, February, there was a study that came out showing that when it comes to fast food, it's not low-income families that are going and eating fast food. It's middle-class families, because eating out, even McDonald's, is still more expensive than cooking at home. It's cheaper than eating at a nice restaurant.
Sure,
but it's still more expensive than cooking at home. You know, you're still going to spend $3 to $5 a person for sure eating at McDonald's, if not more than that. Whereas at if you're a disciplined cook at home, you can probably feed a family for about $8.
Yeah, you know, this is Tracy. It's I mean, the stories about the different, as you move through these different work environments, to me, were really fascinating in the book, and we've been talking about them a lot. Now, we're sort of just got about maybe 10 minutes not to go in the show, so I don't want to hit the end without at least you can maybe talk about some of your, without giving away the whole ending of the book, and you know, but talk about some of the things that you've sort of maybe concluded, determined, or just feel like, what are some of the things that we can do, that the country can do, that individual people can do, or communities, whatever you're most comfortable talking about, to sort of move the needle on this, to try to help people, make it easier for people to eat better. Because you talk about in the book, you have a quote early in the introduction of the book, I think, where you talk about, like, that, you know we have an obesity problem, you know, in America, and the all the strategies up to now, whatever they are, they're just not really working, right? Because the problem just continues to get worse. And so go eat better and run around more, telling people that just doesn't seem to be working, even though it might be true, it's just not working. So I'd love for you to comment just on a couple of things in your observation and your reporting and your experiences that you'd like to see maybe change, or what we can do a little bit better at.
Sure. So when it comes to individual choices around food, and you know, in the book I write about, you know, I actually think making it easy for people to eat well is more of a government and political problem than an individual one.
Okay.
But, you know, individually, right, folks who already are interested in food and shopping at farmers markets and things like that, I would say just ask your farmer about labor practices and make that an issue that they think about, because a lot of farmers don't think about that. And there's really just the simple act of learning how to cook well, which I think is actually really a key piece of self-sufficiency, because right now we have a lot of folks who might know how to cook a little bit but don't feel confident enough to just cook every night. And that's really an easy way to have a lot of control, self-control over your diet and what you're putting into your bodies, and being able to make demands on companies, right, for a better food supply. Because what we're really talking about right now is having a food supply that's not particularly healthy and not particularly easy. And, you know, what we end up with at this point, you know, is a population that's neither healthy nor fit
right, and
awfully heavy. And then in terms of, you know, sort of broader strategies, I do think that anyone who thinks that they care about food has to care about wages and work life and have a conversation about that. You know, it is more expensive and more time consuming to eat well than it is to eat poorly. And so we've got to have a conversation about how do you make that possible for most Americans. And so then there's also last, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, oh, we should reform subsidies within the agricultural department. And I think there's certainly room for that. We produce way more corn and soy than we need. I really would like to see us start to focus on subsidizing demand, because I think that would create a healthier marketplace as opposed to perverting the incentives for producing food. And I've seen time and again, particularly through matching programs for food stamps at farmers markets, that if you give people basically coupons for fruits and vegetables, they use them and they eat them.
Right.
Right. And that's something we certainly all need to be doing more of. Right now, only about 12% of Americans eat enough fruits and vegetables. And, you know, not so coincidentally, you know, we only grow about half the fruits and vegetables required for every American to meet their recommended daily allowance in the U.S.
Yeah, that's another note I had in my notes, Tracy. That to me is fascinating. Again, never thinking about that, but it makes so much sense, right, in terms of, okay, here's a plan. Here's what we, you know, we think we need to consume as an average person, right? You need to have four or five servings, whatever it is, right? But not even really sort of thinking, is the supply even there? Even if maybe because the people who set those targets know most of us won't hit them, right? So the supply doesn't really need to be there. But it
right,
is
which
kind
is
of
sort
weird,
of where, like, the subsidizing demand comes into play,
yeah.
Right? Like, there's actually a study from the USDA showing that coupons are a much more effective tool at shifting consumer behavior than are even lower prices. So they did something, you know, sort of saying, well, if fruits and vegetables are 10% lower, or if we give people coupons for 10% off, what's more effective? And it's the coupon.
Right.
You know, and so if you give people those sorts of incentives to start eating better, you also create a market so that farmers can reliably produce that stuff and have a market for it and build a living off of it, as opposed to, you know, right now we subsidize all this production for corn and soy, which just means people grow more and more and more of it than we actually need.
Right. And then you can get into, right, and so much of that corn is going to feed animals anyway, right? Not really food for people or things like that. Wow, you know, man, Tracy, I know that we're just about at the top of the hour here, so we'll need to wrap it up. But there's a lot more to the book than we just touched upon, all sort of the key highlights as your journey across the country. It literally was, too. I like how it was sort of started in the West, moved to sort of the Midwest, ended up on the East. But it's really an interesting book. I highly recommend it if you're, you know, if you're an American, which most of the people listening to the show probably are, and if you eat, which we know everyone does, I definitely recommend checking out The American Way of Eating. Amazon and everywhere else books can be found. And Tracy, website for the book is AmericanWayOfEating.wordpress.com, of course. Tracy, just last final things. What's next? Next projects? Anything else coming up? Or are you still sort of digesting? That's a bad pun, I'm sorry. For everything that's happened with this book, and it's still before you sort of move on to the next big project.
No, I'm working on a little bit more. I'm doing some reporting on farm labor for a piece that I hope will be out this summer. Working on another book proposal, hopefully, and it looks like I'm going to be doing a fellowship, a journalism fellowship this fall. So I'll hopefully be able to take a bit of a breather and focus on both of those things.
Well, that's fantastic. So I wish you lots of luck with those things, of course, and it's just been so exciting. And thank you so much, Tracy, for making the time to be with us. I know that you've, in the last few months, just been everywhere, like I said, all over the media, all over television. We're not going to get into all that other nonsense because we're out of time anyway, but I just really do appreciate you taking the time to be with us tonight as well, and wish you a lot of continued success with this book and whatever comes next.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Steve.
All right, Tracy, thank you very much. That was Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating. Again, I definitely recommend you check it out. It was super of her to be with us tonight. Just a couple last final thoughts before we wrap up the show. Of course, many thanks to our friends at Acquire Software for always for long-term sponsorship of the HR Happy Hour show. Once again, this episode of HR Happy Hour was brought to you by Acquire, the leader in workforce planning and analytics solutions. You can try Org Publisher Premier, the subscription-based software that's the holy grail of automatic org charts. Free as a 30-day no-hassle trial. If you like it and keep it, you can spin it up to your finance department that you paid nothing for the first month you used it. To get started on your Org Publisher Premier trial, visit acquire.com, A-Q-U-I-R-E.com. Wow, that's it. I'm beat. I've had a long, busy traveling week, been all over the country myself. Glad to be home, tired, wrapping it up. What's coming up next on the show is actually, I'm not sure. I think the show, HR Happy Hour show, we might go on a little bit of a summer schedule for the summer months, June, July, August. I'll be working on that, and I'll let everybody know, put it on the blog as well. But we'll probably scale back for a little while I catch my breath and take a little time off as well this summer. So many thanks to Tracy McMillan, of course, for being with us tonight. Many thanks to the folks who are listening, the back channel, of course. Really appreciate you, as always. And we'll see you next time on the HR Happy Hour show. Good night, everyone. Thank you.